talk today a bit about what I know of the integral geometry of some random sets. And so just give you a brief outline. I'm going to start off with a model for random sets, an explicit model. And you'll see in the examples in just a second that what makes this a very different kind of randomness than what we saw earlier this morning, for instance, in Sarah and Joshi's talk, where you have obvious structure and you're trying to find, you know, perhaps a noisy approximation to this obvious structure. This model for random sets that I'm talking about, the random field models, are kind of models in the absence of structure. So you'll see that there's no highly structured data like the like cortical surfaces in what I'm going to talk about, but rather this is the statisticians guarding against neuroscientists getting too excited about particular clusters of activation they see. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some old things from integral geometry that go back at least 50 years and try and explain how these random sets and the integral geometry of these random sets is related to these old ideas in integral geometry. And that's going to come under the heading of what I'll call Gaussian integral geometry, where the model for random sets come from a Gaussian random field, and there's some deep some connection to this old integral geometry. And if I have any time, I'm going to try and put together some of the intuition behind this connection in Gaussian integral geometry. And there's some very nice, it was a very satisfying thing to work through because it used some very old idea in Gaussian processes known as Poincaré's limit, which you can essentially derive most of the strong path properties of Gaussian processes known today can be derived from this kind of limit. And there was some nice geometry in there, some curvature measures of warp products, warp Riemannian products, that led to these some generalized curvature measures. So there's a really nice geometric story in this field, and I'll try and give you some ideas of that. So this is really a math talk, more than a statistics talk. Okay, so what are the random sets we're going to consider? We're going to take a basic building block. My building block is going to be a twice differentiable Gaussian random field on some manifold M. In all my examples, actually it won't be a manifold, I'll show you a cube. So you can have manifolds with corners if you want, but theory works for any smooth enough process on a smooth enough manifold. And I'm going to have mean 0 and variance 1 as the sort of the null. This is a model for null noise with no signal on the manifold. And why am I going to work with Gaussians? Well, they're the easiest processes in the world to work with, except perhaps the Poisson process. All I need to specify a Gaussian process is the mean function, which I've already done. I set it to 0, so there's no structure there, and the covariance function. Here I haven't specified a covariance function, and I'm not going to give you a specific model for a covariance function, because actually all that's going to show up in the results are local properties of covariance in terms of Riemannian metrics. So I don't even have to fully specify my covariance function for you. And of course, why are they so easy to work with? They're easy to specify, and everything is multivariate Gaussian. Finite dimensional distributions are quite easy to work with. And I'm going to make more complicated processes out of these Gaussian processes, like a chi-squared process, for instance. I'll take maybe k of these fields, independent copies, square them, and add them up to get a chi-squared field. Okay.
So stupid question. If I integrate Brownian motion twice on the line, do I get one of these?
Well, you'd have to normalize by the variance. But yes, on the line, you actually only need...
it's the twice differentiable.
On the line, you don't need twice differentiable. You actually need only almost differentiable. I mean, but that's counting up crossing. But in the plane, you do need twice differentiable. You might be able to get away with once differentiable with the Lipschitz gradient, but because a lot of the integral geometry depends on that kind of stuff. But we're taking two derivatives. Okay. So what are the random sets? We're going to consider what we call excursion sets or upper level sets, we're going to take the inverse image of a set A. So right now I only have one process, so it's not very exciting. This is usually, say, a half open interval or a point, and look at the inverse image under this random function. So that's all points in the parameter space where the random field is in this set A. So if it's a point, it's the level set of the random function. And we're interested in the geometry of these random sets. So what can we say about geometry, in particular integral geometry?
So A is like a projection
region,
right?
It will be, yes. Yeah. I mean, but for the problem, A is anything for now, because I'm not just going to talk about natural rejection regions. But yeah, I mean, statistically, this is a rejection region, but I haven't even got to what the statistics problem is. And I'm going to probably ignore a lot of that from. Okay, so let's just give you an idea of what one of these things might look like. Let's do three different ones, and I'll do level one. So, just a second, it will change in theory, unless it crashes. So what I'm doing here is I'm simulating a smooth Gaussian random field on the cube, and I'm just drawing the isosurface where it's equal to one. And these are random sets. And you see, as I said, there's nothing preserved from realization to realization. So unlike what we saw in Sarah Ryan's talk, where you had an underlying, you know, average surface you were trying to capture, these are models for random sets when you have no underlying structure. And their application, the statistical application is, well, let's suppose we had an image of test statistics, and the level is very high, let's say 2 maybe. Let's see if I can get one that looks nice and simply connected.
What's the covariance structure?
This is just a Gaussian kernel.
Gaussian kernel.
Yeah, I mean, for this simulation. Yeah, so the results I'm going to talk about, they're independent of the covariance function, except that I have 2 derivatives, and that's encoded. Well, 2 derivatives and induces a C2 Riemannian metric, but I'm not going to quote that particularly. So the idea, the statistical application in terms of guarding against false positives is, suppose we did a functional imaging experiment and we found all these regions had very high threshold. Well, there's no actual structure in here, and we want to be able to say something about what's the probability you would have observed this, even if there's nothing really going on in your experiment. And that's what Keith spent a lot of time talking about in his talk yesterday. I wanted to sort of talk about, well, these sets in general, and what can we say about them? Let's go back to the slides. Okay. So what geometric features am I going to talk about? Well, what motivates the application is the expected Euler characteristic of, well, this set, if I take a half open interval to the right, the excursion set above the level u, this is the quantity that's of applied statistical interest in the problems that, for instance, Keith was talking about. And so the expected Euler characteristic of the random set, which is m intersect, well, the inverse image u infinity. And well, if that's just defined on M, then you don't have to put the M there. I'll put it there just to be explicit. And well, what does this expected Euler characteristic do for you? So the Euler characteristic is a topological property of these sets. And in some senses, it doesn't tell you very much. So if I take any 2 manifold without boundary and a smooth enough covariance, the expected Euler characteristic of the nodal domain, that is the zero level set, is 1/2 the Euler characteristic of M. So that doesn't tell you that, and that doesn't depend on anything about the covariance structure at all. So that this expected Euler characteristic at some levels tells you nothing, and if you put in a boundary, you have something to do with the edge length of the manifold. And here I haven't said exactly how you compute edge length. I'll get to that in a moment, because of course, if I just have an arbitrary manifold with boundary, you need a Riemannian metric or something to compute the length, and there is one that comes from the process. Okay. So on this, on the one hand, it tells you very little, but on the other hand, for the statistical applications that we're interested in, we go through with this heuristic argument that we what Keith went through yesterday, this expected order characteristic tells you a lot. And so for nice enough parameter sets M, that includes M being a manifold, M being locally convex, like the cube, this expected Euler characteristic is a very accurate approximation to the probability you observe anything above the level U. So in this picture, for this particular Gaussian process, I could work out the expected Euler characteristic above this level 2 here, and that would be a good approximation, and how good the approximation is depends on how high the level goes, of the probability I would see anything here. And the idea in the statistical application is to choose this level U high enough so that this probability is about 0.05, if you're trying to control Fermi-Weiss error rate of 0.05. Okay, so that, let's go back to full screen. This expected Euler characteristic tells you something at high levels. And well, you might ask, okay, so we know, maybe you can prove that expected Euler characteristic is close to the supremum distribution. Well, also, the expected number of local maxima above the level U would also probably be close to the supremum distribution, and in fact would be an upper bound to the supremum distribution. So why do we use the expected Euler characteristic? Well, the miracle is that it's actually explicitly computable. You can compute the expected Euler characteristic above the level U. You can compute the expected number of local maxima above the level U, exactly. Except there are a few isotropic fields where you can do that, but for most processes, you can't. And so you can just say basically that the expected number of local maxima is essentially asymptotically the same as this quantity, which we already know anyways. And what is the expected Euler characteristic above the level U? Well, it depends on the manifold M and this threshold U. And so what I really want to get across in this talk is somehow where do these quantities come from and what are these quantities. So here I have what I'll call the total curvature measures of the manifold M, and here these are what Keith calls the EC densities at level U. And they're geometric interpretations to both of these things, and that's what we're going to do. Okay. Yes?
In this limit of U going to infinity, in the idea of how compared to standard deviation of F, how far does U have to be?
Once I talk a little bit about these, I'm going to say, I'll tell you what the exponential behavior of the relative error is. So it's exponentially sharp relative in terms of relative error. So
this convergence is exponential.
Yes, each of these terms here, these are like e to the minus u squared over 2, and the relative error, the relative error is e to the minus u squared over 2 something else. So the error is like e to the minus u squared over 2 times something bigger than 1 in the exponent. So relative error, it's found.
So between the probability and the expectation.
Yes, yeah, I mean, just take the difference, look at the absolute value, and divide by, you can get the exponential decay of that, and it's faster than any of the terms in the series. Yeah. Okay. But that's we can only prove that for the Gaussian processes. For these other processes, like an F process, you can't necessarily prove that yet. But there's some, in theory you can. So, I was going to spend a little time talking about the motivation and why a statistician would care about this problem. And I think I'm going, in the interest of time, I'm not going to talk about that. And we had to talk about that yesterday. But very briefly, this supremum distribution, while you can make it appear in the brain imaging context when you do voxelwise analysis and trying to signal detection in brain images, it also has other statistical applications that appear in multivariate analysis and non-standard likelihood ratio tests. That is, there's in statistics, mathematical statistics, we're taught, if you do the likelihood ratio test, cross your fingers, count the difference in the number of degrees of freedom, that's going to be a chi-square. Well, that's not always true. And often when it's not true, you can express the distribution of likely ratio in terms of a problem like this. So there are other statistical applications of it besides this brain imaging or the astrophysical ones. Okay, so this was, I was going to spend a few minutes going through a slide like that, then I'm not going to. I'm going to go jump right into trying to describe what those coefficients LJ and rho J are. They're geometric. So the first coefficient I want to tell you what it is are the dependence on the parameter set. And they come up in two formulas. We also heard Keith mention this the other day. So I'm going to specialize my problem a little bit. So I'm going to suppose that my manifold M is embedded in Euclidean space. So and I'm going to assume that my process is the restriction to this manifold of an isotropic process on RK. And I'm going to assume that I fix everything up so that the variance of the derivative is 1. That doesn't really matter. The reason I'm going to do this is because then I can give you a simple explanation of what the coefficients LJ of M are. They are coefficients in a tube formula. So we're in RK. Let's take Lebesgue, I'll just call it HK, because I like using Hausdorff because I can index it by what dimension I'm talking about. But the Lebesgue measure of the tube of radius R around M, that's all points that are distance less than or equal to R to M. And for small enough R, you can prove that this is a polynomial. And the coefficients of this polynomial are the total curvature measures LJ of M. And here I started to put in a second parameter into these LJs. That's because, well, there's two parameters to the curvature measures, but those coefficients LJ of M are, well, what happens when I put in M or all of RK here? So I'll tell you what these curvature measures are as well, but these are those constants LJ of M. And I'll go through some examples for the cube and for a domain, how you might compute these coefficients. But this is always under the assumption that I had an isotropic process and I had my embedded submanifold of RK. But the result I gave you before doesn't depend on this isotropy. So you have to determine what are these LJs in that case. Well, these curvature measures are defined for Riemannian manifolds and for sort of locally convex subsets of Riemannian manifolds. And so where do we get the Riemannian metric? We get it from the process itself. You get one way of thinking of a random field, or a one-dimensional stochastic process, is a mapping from the parameter space you're in to a space of random variables. So we can think of a random field on an arbitrary manifold, M, as a function that maps the manifold into L2 or into the reproducing kernel Hilbert space, if you like. That's just a linear basically a linear subspace of L2. And if the assumption that we have two derivatives, if it's twice differentiable, it almost surely for Gaussian it will be twice differentiable in L2, and so that means that's a C2 map from M into L2, and we can pull back the inner product from L2 to get a Riemannian metric on the manifold, and that's what shows up in these terms here. So these things are hiding a lot of curvatures that you would not necessarily ever want to compute for a particular example, but I can write down what they are in less than a line for a manifold. In LaTeX, to write down for locally convex things, to write down what the curvature measures are, it takes three lines of LaTeX. They're kind of complicated things, but they appear nice and simple there. Okay. So that's what those.
Sorry.
Yes.
What is that? It's how to measure. It's not like, why it's not the Lebesgue measure?
If you're an RK, you can choose HK, normalize it to be Lebesgue. But just because when I'm integrating over lower dimensional submanifolds, I want to just, the index on the Hausdorff tells me what dimension is that set. So it's this is a nice set, so the Hausdorff measure and Lebesgue measure are the same ones.
Okay.
So, it's just for notational purposes, I like that, because, you can't write the Lebesgue measure on a co-dimension one.
Just for convenience.
Okay. So I'll show you a picture about, for instance, how you might compute these coefficients for something very simple, like a cube. And we just, the list of examples that you can compute them for is very short. So let's do a cube, or let's be a little more general, let's have unequal side lengths. Well, how do you compute the tube? Well, if you draw a tube around this cube, you can decompose it into parts that are near a corner, nearest a corner, parts that are nearest an edge, and parts that are nearest a face, as well as the interior. And so, well, without too much work, a little bit of high school geometry, you can figure out that the volume of this tube is the following polynomial, and you'd see for this rectangle, it's the elementary symmetric polynomials of the edge length. So that works in all RK, that one rather nice. But not everything is cubed like that. What if you had a smooth domain? Well, I have two purposes for this picture. How would you do it for a smooth domain D? Well, along this domain D, at every point you have, if it's smooth, you have a unique outward pointing normal vector. And what you do is you look at the map that takes, you know, the point X in the boundary to X plus R times nu of X, where nu is that outward normal pointing vector field, and you work out the Jacobian of that mapping, and you write that out, and that's what the answer is. It's kind of complicated, but it's not too bad. But I want to tell you what these curvature measures are, right? In the answer for the Gaussian process, I only had constants, but it's the total mass of a signed measure. And what are these signed measures? Well, let's say I have a set A in the plane. You look at the intersection of A here with the boundary of D, and you find, what you do is you look at the surface area at distance R, all points that project to A intersect D, and you compute its surface area as a function of R. And so that turns out to be a measure like that you, and this is what that measure is. And that's what the curvature measures are. And so for a domain in RK, you can, without too much more work, you can see that this curvature measure is the integral of some constant times the elementary symmetric polynomials of the eigenvalues, or the principal curvatures of the boundary. The eigenvalues of the shape operator, and you integrate that over the boundary. And you can imagine, this is, even if it's isotropic, you can imagine that trying to do this with non-isotropic data, with not knowing the covariance, that this is going to be quite difficult to do. We also heard from Keith how we can solve that. Often in the data applications of this random field theory, we have data collected on something that can be triangulated, either a cortical surface, which is already triangulated, or a collection of voxels that we can triangulate into tetrahedra. And these Lipschitz Kellum curvatures can be defined combinatorially for simplicial complexes, and so we can use that to estimate the curvatures. Okay, so these are examples of the densities of that, estimates of the densities of these measures, if you like, or a particular functional experiment. So now I'm going to get to Sharon's question about the accuracy shortly. Now, this implicit definition I gave you, I define them as coefficients in a polynomial, and I said there was some R small enough so that volume as a function of R is a polynomial, but that's not true for all sets. And this notion of local convexity is important if you're using this implicit definition of curvature measures. So here, this L here is an example of a set that where the Steiner-Weyl tube formula fails. So it's not very complicated. Any polygonal curve, you can't use that formula for the Lipschitz-Kellum curvatures, because down here at this corner, you would, if the Steiner vial formula was going to be correct, this green thing would have to be round, but it's square. That's sort of weird way of, I mean, if you work it out, this would have to be round for everything to cancel out correctly. And so this implicit definition only works for manifolds that have, or sets that have positive reach. And one way to define the reach of a set is the smallest radius, sorry, the largest radius, that's wrong. The largest radius, such that the Steiner vial tube formula is exact for the volume of the tube around a given set. And this comes up in the accuracy of the expected Euler characteristic heuristic. So I claim that the expected Euler characteristic is like the Suprema distribution, and you can give something about the relative error. So the relative error is e to the minus u squared over 2 times some critical variance. And this variance, if I could give you a definition, but again, it could take a while, unless it's a manifold with boundary, this variance is something like an analog of reach, but it's reach in the set of random variables. So the random field is a function from my manifold to a set of random variables, and what determines the accuracy of this approximation is actually this notion of reach. And if you have a manifold without boundary, this is a way, I mean, you can always express this relative error as follows, and for a manifold without boundary, well, you have to work out the maximum of this variance of this two-parameter process fxy, which is defined like that. And yes, but if it's a manifold with corners, it's not as simple, but you can make a process that to get identify this critical variance.
What is it all? The smaller that is, the bigger the reach.
So actually, you know what the problem is, when you have a singular set, this variance is infinite. This variance is infinite. So you want to have it small, as small as possible.
Right. So it's really.
Yes, it's like the reach, I mean, it's 1 over the reach or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's essentially, it's curvature rather than radius, yes.
What does it all?
Yeah. When you have manifolds with corner?
Yeah.
Well, you have to construct it, the process is different. So this variance is going to be infinite whenever the set isn't sort of locally convex. And the process you need to use here has something to do with the projection of the gradient onto the normal cone at every point. And it would just take a long time to figure it out. Yeah. So, but when it's a manifold without boundary, the normal cone is a linear space.
So what's the little c?
Critical.
Okay. What's f sub y super x?
That's a process.
Okay.
Yeah, and when it's a manifold without boundary, I can tell you the process very simply. When it's a manifold with boundary or with corners, this process, you have to add a few things on this process, and there's some projection onto a normal cone.
So rho of x, y is
a correlation function. Sorry, that's not written. Yes, covariance between fx and fy.
Sorry, still I don't understand this f, x, y. So you have a 2 points, x and y, on the manifold.
Yes.
So what f basically represents in this case? Relative to 2 points, x and y.
This f, x, y?
Yeah.
I mean, so look, if y is near x, so let's say it's in a direction x, x, like a tangent direction near x, this thing is like minus the second derivative of f in that direction. And if it's far, it's just, well, it's just some... you know, this is y minus its projection onto x and the tangent space of x. And actually, that's it's hard to say exactly what it is, but I mean, this will be small in variance if f of y is near f of x.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is, if you can have y's that where f of y is near f of x in random variables, but not really in the parameter space. That's sort of global overlap of the two.
A one-dimensional process, and the correlation is with the process of its second derivative, or the inverse of that.
Well, again, it depends. Yeah, I mean, it depends on the, if you have a monotone decreasing covariance function. I mean, yeah, so this is the right answer whenever you don't have without boundary, and if I can give you the process with boundary, but I can't give you geometric interpretation of the answer. This process, well, it just turns out to be the right thing to use. And it's like, well, this variance is like the cotangent of an angle, actually. And so somehow it's measuring the angle, some angle related to this process.
When you say this boundary, you mean the random process will have to obey the same constraints, a constraint random field?
Well, it's defined on a parameter set with boundary.
So you have to reject a lot of stuff until some of them fit.
No, I mean, I have a Gaussian process.
You have a boundary.
Yeah, I mean, and it's you know, it's almost surely a C2 function on this manifold with boundary. That's Gaussian. That's all. I mean, there's no rejecting. It's just, that's what it is. Okay, so the accuracy depends on some notion of the reach. Let's see how I'm doing. Now, how many minutes do I have left? We started a few minutes late.
As many as you want.
Okay. Well, no, I don't want to take as many as I want, but I do want to try and give a little.
So if the manifold is at, say, abstract compact.
What does that mean? You mean by
M?
Yeah. Yeah. If it's not actually all of this
is relative.
M is compact. You know, otherwise, the supreme is going to blow up. That's,
it doesn't have the signal in Euclidean. It can be abstract.
Oh yeah. I mean, all these results are abstract.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then there's. Is there some geometric construction that's analogous to reach? I gotta stick it in, to have reach, I gotta stick something inside something.
Yes, well, so that it's embedded in L2. And this is like the reach in L2. And I mean, you can prove when it's without boundary, it is, so it's embedded in the sphere in L2, it is the reach in the sphere in L2. You can prove that. When you have a boundary, with this projection of the normal cone, it's kind of hard to do that. Yes?
If you really stick with the sphere, if you make a manifold for the sphere,
mm-hmm.
can you work all this out?
If you can work it out for an arbitrary submanifold of the sphere, I mean, it doesn't make your life any easier.
It doesn't make it any easier. Okay, I'm just wondering if you, if you can.
Yeah. No, I mean, these computing these curvatures are intrinsic, so it doesn't matter what representation you use. If you find one that works, I mean, they're really only computable for very symmetric manifolds or, you know, very nice, well-behaved, like the cubes, spheres, it behaves nice under products or products of spheres, things like that. So with a product metric, you can do things like that. Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about the other things, which is, I think, actually the kind of neater aspect of this work, is how the threshold or the rejection region shows up. So I'm going to spend a few minutes now going back to some old things in integral geometry called kinematic fundamental formulae. And these are other places where we see these curvature measures.
Ultimately, you will say there's something about the rows.
Yes, that's what unless I get cut off. Yes, I want to. That's my goal.
See, I don't know this part. I don't know what the rows are.
Well, I can tell you what the rows are, but the construct, or to see why they have anything geometric, it comes from the kinematic fundamental formula, and a limit of the kinematic fundamental formula. I'm not going to spend much time on, I'll write the whole ugly formula, but I'm not going to spend much time on the constant. Just want to give the audience who haven't seen the KFF a little reminder. Okay. So these are other places in integral geometry where you see the Lipschitz-Killing curvatures, and what are they? Well, we're going to start with two subsets of the plane, Euclidean space, or the sphere. Actually, we're going to use a kinematic fundamental formula of the sphere later, and we take what I'll call a random translation by a rigid body transformation of M2 and look at its intersection with M1. Well, if I'm talking about sets in the plane, I can't really make it random because it's not finite measure. I could on the sphere, and I will in a little bit. But you can think of this like Buffon's needle problem, where you don't have just planes and a needle. You have two sets. Take a random translation and look at the set, their intersection, this green part. And what can you say about the curvature measures of this green set? And it involves the curvature measures of M1 and M2. So there's a lot of formulas on this slide, but we're going to go very quickly through it. So formally, what do? You write this as an integral against the isometric group of rigid motions, fix a hard measure on the group, and you look at the integral of the ith intrinsic volume, or a curvature measure, of M1 intersect GM2, and that turns out to be some sum of things involving M1 and M2. Okay, and there's formulas on the sphere and other spaces of constant negative curvature as well. Another place they show up is Crofton's formula. I'm going to skip Crofton's formula, but I want to show you, rewrite that main result in something that looks like a kinematic fundamental formula, and then I'm going to tell you the results right after that. Okay, so the Gaussian result, I was looking at the expected Euler characteristic of M intersect this inverse image of this set. Well, just writing expectation as an integral and Euler characteristic as L0, that starts to look like the kinematic fundamental formula, right? It's a parameter set M intersect, well, instead of G, I have F inverse of some set, half open interval, and I'm integrating against the probability measure. And the answer I told you was this linear combination, and I claim, well, that looks kind of like the KFF. I put in M, and I got the intrinsic volumes of M out. I put in this set, and I got something to do with U out, so this should be somehow an additive functional of the set U, because, well, this thing is additive in this parameter here. So what is this additive functional? Okay. So I'm going to try and tell you what the result is for a little more general additive functional. So I'm going to take K independent copies of my Gaussian process instead of just one of them, and I'm going to look at this functional. I'm going to take a set D and RK and look at the expected Euler characteristic of M intersect the inverse image of D by F. And that gives me other examples of random shapes. Let me just give you a few examples. If you really did mean I have as much time as I want, that I could spend a few more times. So for instance, the Gaussian one, this is just the boundary of the set, but if I take a half space in RK and I look at its inverse image, I get the excursion set of a Gaussian field. This is the one we've already seen. Why is it taking so long? Okay, but I could take this one, I think, is what we call a chi-bar statistic. I could take something bounded by this red surface and look at that random set. Okay, that's another model of some random set. A few more, and then I'll tell you what the answer is. But the point is, this is a cone, it's really the F-statistic cone, actually. The point is, as a function of these red things, the answer, the average curvature properties of the blue things are an additive functional, and we've seen that these other additive functionals in the KFF have something to do with tubes, and so I'm going to tell you how it's related to tubes in just a second. This is an F. Okay, I'm wasting time here.
But so when you prove this thing, do you isometrically embed it?
You start off by proving it with a process on the sphere, and then you show sort of an invariance result that it's got to be true for other.
So in the proof, you really do work with tubes in Euclidean space?
With the sphere, yes. Yeah.
In the sphere. Yeah.
Okay, now my computer's freezing. I knew I shouldn't have done this. I don't have a graphics card like Keith, so it's kind of slow. Okay, I will, as soon as I can get back, get back. But it looks like I might crash my X. Yes, okay. So that crashed, but that's fine. Okay. So essentially what I was trying to show in pictures is we're going to take the set D and look at this inverse image. And well, what are the functionals? So I'm going to give you another implicit definition of additive functional on RK. So instead of taking Lebesgue measure, or I had Hausdorff K measure on RK, I'm going to take the same tube of radius R, and I'm going to compute the standard Gaussian measure of that tube. So that's with a density, a covariance matrix of identity and mean zero. And I'm just going to do my best to expand that in a power series. And I get formal power series. In some cases, you can show that it converges. But the coefficients of these power series are what shows up in this additive functional. So if you look at the expected Euler characteristic of M intersect F inverse of D? Well, it's a sum of something to do with the parameter set and something to do with the set D. And that's this Gaussian kinematic fundamental formula. And let's see if I can, let's see if I can give some sketch of the proof. Okay, and then I'm going to stop, if that's okay. I'm cutting into his time. It's your time, Paul, so I don't know.
No, go ahead.
Okay. So, this is a loop bar. I actually already said this. Okay, so I'm going to give you some elements of the proof, and it's basically just going to be applying this kinematic fundamental formula to a special kind of process that converges to that process I had with the k-independent copies of the Gaussian process. And that's this convergence is through this thing called Poincaré's limit. So I quoted the kinematic fundamental formula in the Euclidean space. It also has a version for spaces of constant curvature, like the sphere of radius square root of n in Rn, which has constant curvature 1 over n. But you have to replace all those intrinsic those curvature measures by a one-parameter family of curvature measures, and it depends on the curvature. They're just linear functions of the original ones, but I won't get into that right now. So you can write these other curvature measures of M1 intersect GM2 for sets in the sphere as linear combinations with the same coefficients of these other curvature measures of M1 and M2. And we're going to construct a process where the expected Euler characteristic is exactly of this form. And the process I'm going to use is now not defined on the same probability space. I'm going to define it on the orthogonal group and my manifold M, which is a submanifold of R of Euclidean space of some dimension. So I'm going to find the process, it's indexed by N, because I have an asymptotic parameter, at point X and omega, that's the randomness, is a random orthogonal matrix. What I'm going to do is I'm going to multiply the projection of the first k coordinates of G times X by square root of n. That gives me a random field as k components. And this classical theorem called Poincaré's limit says that in distribution, this process converges to that Gaussian process that would be indexed by this subset of the sphere. And you can even make the statement stronger than distribution, it's total variation, and actually even stronger than that if you want. So it's a very strong sense of convergence. And so if we can compute the expected Euler characteristic for these processes and have enough conditions to take a limit, we can get the answer for the Gaussian processes. So now, there's a lot of formulas here, but it's just formal manipulation shows that for this particular process, this doesn't look very good, but if I take M intersect the inverse image of D under this process, well, that's a random set that depends on my random orthogonal matrix G, and it just turns out to be this. I mean, that's just formal inverse images. It's nothing very complicated. And this is what shows up in the GKF, in the KFF, right? So I can write for any of these particular functionals for this, as in this process Fn, I can figure them out in terms of the spherical KFF and ignore all the constants there, but you can figure it out. And well, now what do we have to do? The last thing we have to do is you have to work out the curvature measures of this set and take a limit. And that's kind of complicated. Well, what are this set? This set has two pieces.
It depends only on U, nothing else, correct?
Part of U being?
The original superlevel.
This has nothing to do. Yeah, this is a Gauss. Now this is living in the Gaussian. Yes. Yeah, this is nothing. This is all the covariances that sort of encoded here. This has nothing to do with the process anymore. And so this, I mean, finishing the proof, it's kind of a miracle that it does turn out to be the two coefficients. What do you have to do to finish the proof? Well, you have to work out this limit. And this is limits of curvature measures of a warped product where the dimension of the sphere and the warp is growing with n. And so you have to do some calculus. And it turns out then that the limits depend not on the curvature measures of D, but on something called the generalized curvature measures of D, which you can think of as a measure or an n minus 1 current on the tangent bundle, or a k minus 1 current on the tangent bundle of Rk, if you work it out. And well, then you have an integral representation of this thing, but you still don't know that it's those coefficients in the tube expansion. So you have to actually go through the combinatorics to show that the formal, when you work out everything for this limit, that the coefficients are what you would get if you expanded in this power series to begin with. And if you didn't know that, you just had some integral representation of the functional, well, you couldn't use any of these neat tricks that we've used to compute the EC densities for these, like the Gaussian random field, the chi-squared, or the T-field. So it's kind of, I mean, I was kind of stunned. It's kind of a miracle that it turns out to be these two coefficients. All this kinematic fundamental formula stuff tells you there's something to do with the curvature measures of D and the generalized curvature measures, but you still show that it's two coefficients is kind of still a miracle, I think. Anyways, so, and there's some more technical details to work out. This only worked for some processes. You have to use a certain invariance principle to show it works for all processes, and I've taken way too much time.